one thing. Roger, Roger.
Did you box moving target?
No, I took an auto track.
Oh, okay.
Oh my gosh, dude.
Wow, look at the try.
Hi, I'm Howard with UFOs UAP Podcast 6, continuing coverage of the June 25th Pentagon UAP reveal. I have permission to hear a Q&A discussion with retired F-16 fighter pilot Chris Leto, who has expert knowledge of the video and radar systems in the F-18 jets flown by Commander Dave Fravor and Commander Alex Dietrich, who were featured on CBS 60 Minutes, May 16, 2021. In 2004, Dave and Alex engaged the Tic Tac UAP with visual contact with their two eyes off the coast of San Diego. Chris is discussing in great technical details the UAP radar videos officially unclassified in April 2020, but leaked in 2017 with two other videos. His guests in this Q&A are DJ San Marco, who is with UFO Twitter, UAP Task Force, and Nathan. They have a podcast that covers mainly UFOs called Life, MMA, and NBA. Though we don't have a new report from the Pentagon, this information and analysis is new. Let's listen in.
I'm Chris Leto. Welcome to the channel. This is a informal live stream, so my basic first live stream with basically some recent friends, DJ and Nathan. DJ, he is a UAP analyst, essentially. He retired from the Air Force back in 2011, so 10 years ago, as a flight engineer. So he's used a lot of these systems. He has tons of hours as well. So DJ is with us. As well as Nathan. So Nathan, I'll let them both introduce themselves here here shortly, but he also works on the podcast with DJ. It's Life MMA and MBA is the name of their podcast. They've run for several years now. And so Nathan, he is very interested in all this UAP stuff and enters to really ask questions. The idea is they were interested in why is the Tic Tac extraordinary. So a little over to you, DJ. Tell us about yourself and why you're here.
Yes, sir. So yes, this is a different iteration of many podcasts I've done. Most of my podcasts have been MMA focused. This year I started doing Life MMA and NBA just so that I could cover a variety of different topics. I wanted to step away from trying to popularize the UFC because of how they treat their fighters. Nathan and I just started doing some stuff together in the last month or so because I had him on with Andy of That UFO Podcast, and Nathan was so brilliant that in analyzing the UAP phenomenon that I just wanted to do more stuff with him. And once you hear him, you'll understand why. But yeah, former Air Force flight engineer, about just under 4,000 hours of flying.
On which aircraft? Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. You know, I started off in the C-130H like a lot of guys. You fly what we call slicks before you go into AFSOC. And then if you get yourself selected going to AFSOC, I flew the Combat Talon 2. Most of my time was on that. And then I did my last 3 years. Combat Talon 2 is like a low-level infill, exfil, airdrop, resupply.
Special forces.
Yeah.
So as you can see, there's some really impressive background on these pilots, and we're going to hear more details. So now we're going to hear from Nathan.
So Nathan, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
An average American just coming into this topic in recent years, like a lot of folks who follow this, really interested to learn more, get your perspective, and ask some questions that I think are on a lot of people's minds. About where we go from here if in fact these things are doing what they are purported to be doing.
DJ, we were talking a little bit before we started here, but your point is basically, your argument is that there's so many witnesses, especially for the Nimitz encounters. If you look at the Nimitz encounter, and I just started looking really deeply into the evidence and listening to all of the witness accounts And you look, there's just so many people that actually just looked at these with their eyes, you know, with binoculars on the Nimitz. You know, you have almost, what, 5,000 people or something in a carrier group. And these things were following them, supposedly, in 2004, following the Nimitz, to where you could just go up and use the Big Eye, which is this big camera system right on the front. And Gary Voorhees was saying that he would just go look at the Big Eye and then ended up just using his binocular.
It's true. Hundreds of people on the Navy ship saw these objects with their eyes.
You know, that's what you do in any, like, crash safety investigation, is you make sure that every single possible explanation is ruled out. You know, but for this purpose of this, really, is just what if we can just assume, for the purpose of this conversation, that the Tic Tac is legitimate, so all of the claims that were made were correct. You know, what does that tell us about why it's extraordinary? And, you know, and basically, if there's any questions about the FLIR system, so I have it set up here. I have, like, my Xbox set up so we can talk through, basically, you know, this energy circle at the beginning just blows me away. You know, Mick West brought that up, and I was like, man, you're right. Like, because before I thought it was tail on, you know, so basically some points, but really kind of just focusing on the Tic Tac, why it's extraordinary, and basically answering your questions. So an informal kind of question answer session. So that's the idea for this podcast.
And Nathan has a series of questions that he wants to ask from a layperson standpoint, and that's going to add a lot of value, because, like you said, a lot of people, you know, the Army calls them NVDs, you know, night vision devices. We call them NVGs, night vision goggles. I mean, so, you know, we got to, you know, be careful with our terminology. But the most, you know, to me, like, to step through it chronologically, Kevin Day tracking these on radar for several days, I believe 7 days prior to saying to his leadership, I think we ought to send the skipper Craver and his wingmen to engage this and see what it is, visually observe it.
Now that's really amazing information. They've been tracking these UAPs for 7 days before they sent the F-18s out to track them. That's just amazing information. These things are real. They've been seeing them for 7 straight days. I think even longer, 7 days.
The Navy is amazing in their electronic attack capabilities. You know, I worked with, I did electronic attack in the aggressors up in Alaska, and we were using these electronic attack pods.
And you can hear they're talking technical about how those radar electronics work and how detailed they are and how they can zoom in on the target they're looking for. And it's, you know, they know something. I mean, the Navy's know something that we don't know. But I hope we can find out some future Pentagon report.
And the best ones we could get were the DIRFM technology jammers, you know, digital radio frequency memory. It's really digital jammers. And they came from the Navy. You know, the software we were using, the codes, even a lot of the hardware was from the Navy. So the Navy, I think, is just kind of ahead in a lot of ways, in certain ways. You know, I think all the other services have their big advantages and disadvantages. But you bring up a great point. This SPY-1 radar that they just put in, that was a huge upgrade. And from my understanding, you know, again, limited, is that it can see very high up. You know, if you're looking at high missiles, so if you're trying to detect inbound incoming missiles, you're trying to defend certain Middle Eastern countries or whatever. So they look up, actually. That SPY system is looking up. So that's why I can see these things coming down from like 80,000 feet, et cetera.
Or more. I don't know that they want to tell us how high, but they say, he said 80,000 feet at least. If you look at like an air traffic control radar that would spin 360 degrees, little blips would appear on the screen. And it was up to the ability of the radar operator to look at that that on his screen and figure out, okay, that's an aircraft that's traveling at this speed, there's rage rings, and there was a lot of interpretation from the radar operator. Now we're taking those returns, we're sending them through signal processing units, and there's a lot of computerization that's going on with those radar returns that come back that we didn't have. That goes on the aircraft, when we're gonna talk about jamming later on, those signal processors interpreted that they were being jammed.
Just want to comment on that. They say that they've been jammed. The UFOs are jamming the radar of these F-18 ships, and they detected that. But they haven't gone into any detail, but you can hear from what they're saying that they are getting a lot of data on their equipment.
Hundreds or thousands of things that it's interpreting to that they then the operator's going to look at and put their, for them to look at and interpret and give feedback to command.
Did they receive jamming, I guess, from
Alex
has received jamming
of their ship? Yeah. I don't think so. That's the interesting question. So that's almost like a first big question.
Okay.
Did this object not determine that phased array? Either it didn't A, interpret it to be a threat, or B, did not have the ability to jam it, one or the other. Because the energy that's being put out by a SPY-1 is not a focused beam of high RF energy that will literally make you feel warm inside.
If you're tracking something, the best is passive, right? So passively tracking something, obviously they don't know that you see them. But with radar, that's the whole point, is you have to send energy that is being sent back. So they can pick up, they can detect that energy. And when you send the energy, so the way electromagnetic radiation travels is that it's by the square root of the distance, right? So basically, if you have a flashlight and you bring the light up to it, you won't see against a wall, you won't see any light, and then all of a sudden you'll see the light on the wall. You'll see the circle on the wall. You know that's because the energy is dispersed. It decreases by the square of the distance, however that works. Mm-hmm. And so the point is you have to send a lot more energy one way than back, so it's easy to detect that you're being targeted because they have to send double the energy that their rate, well, much more, magnitudes of order more than the energy than the radar needs to detect. You can do a lot of things with ASA, and yeah, it'd be interesting to know. I'm sure they
that's
have
the first anomaly
systems. Yep.
That's the first anomaly, is why didn't it, if it could jam a phased array radar, why didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. Well, the first thing is, what do we know from that? Assuming it's all legit, right? So we're assuming that it's completely, everything's taken at face value. It can pick up these things, right? That was kind of interesting to me, because if you look in a lot of the FLIR videos, none of them have any range, or I believe, none of them show any true range to the target that's based off of energy coming back, right? Because basically you have to send that energy pulse out, and it has to be coded because it's military systems, right? I mean, people have to remember that these systems that we're using, they're all designed with the requirements that they can be anti-spoofed, you know, anti-jammed. So each pulse that it sends out is specifically coded. Also, you don't want to get confused with other random codes out there. But so each little pulse is specifically coded, so when it comes back, it can say, yeah, this is my pulse. And it took this long to go that far, so I know how far away it is, right? That's how the radar pulses it. But what's happening is, for some reason, the ASA, the big system on the ship, right, which has these tiny little, which can send out these little pulses that are hard to detect, that can pick them up, you know, or maybe it's the processing in there. But when you look at, like, the radar, although Chad Underwood did say he picked it up on radar, as soon as it seems like it's getting a lot of energy on it, it just drops it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people have been saying that's it's due to jamming. I guess it could be. There's nothing saying that it isn't. You know, the response is from the radar is that it's being jammed.
The signal processor thinks it's being jammed.
Exactly. All we know for sure, 100%, is that it has been modified, you know, from outside of whatever parameters the radar is expecting. So that's an interesting result to me, is that it has been modified. So it's getting pulses back. So it's reflecting. Mm-hmm. So it's reflecting off this. So if you go, I think I saw one question, you know, like the pulse bubble, or what is it, you know, if it's in like some plasma bubble.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, that would be an interesting question to actually ask, is what happens if you throw radar, a pulse train, you know, because it's a bunch of pulses mm-hmm. in a row. If you throw a pulse train at a plasma, what bounces back? You know, is it?
Yeah, the plasma argument, I mean, it's just so many different hurdles that they would have to leap over in order to be a plasma bubble, because now we'd have to look at where was it projected from. We're in a circle here that was somewhat concentric. So would Fravor have flown through their projection? So there's, I've kind of dismissed the plasma bubble argument. I think this is an object of a substance that the radar on the, that they were able to track and actually make a shape out of it and say, okay, that's a shape. And that shape looks very similar to the Vizov.
As you can hear, they think they've really detected an object, and the radar is detecting it, and they have very sophisticated equipment that they've seen the shape, and it's not plasma, it's not lightning or something like that. This is more information that we've gotten from the UAP report. They're analyzing the gimbal or the Go Fast or the FLIR videos, and they know they're real objects from the equipment because they know how the equipment works. And so this is very exciting information.
So you're saying they were able to shape, like basically shape it from the radar returns?
No, you saw it. I mean, you saw it. Oh, I'm sorry, the FLIR. Excuse me. Yeah. What you're seeing on the FLIR jibes with the VizOb.
Yeah. Exactly.
I don't know what it looked like on radar. We may never know that.
Yeah, I do want to show it later because I've seen a couple arguments saying there's confusion between the TV and the IR mode. You know, in the TV mode, that's, we can talk through a little bit more of that. But let's just finish with the radars. So and basic jamming. So we know the ship saw a bunch of these, right? So it sounds like there was many of them, and then we know that Chad Underwood was able to lock at least get a vector. So sometimes what you'll have on your radar is it'll give you a hit saying that it's receiving some energy there, but then you command a lock on that point. And
I want to say that VizOp, I think, means that they saw it visually with their eyes besides seeing it on the radar and their other equipment. It's very exciting.
E2 is very capable radar as well, and in a different radar band than your Spy 1 radar.
Mm-hmm. Again, and also tracking it.
Yep.
Also yep. Seeing the object and had those tapes pulled. You heard the maintenance guy, the avionics maintenance guy who put those bricks from the E2 in the safe, and an Air Force officer walked in and he said he knows that because of the patches.
That's a crazy story, right? The Men in Black story. This is someone with
civilian clothes with that person.
Was he in a black suit? Like, to be so, just so classic.
There's been a lot that's come out. My eyes, I would say the last 7 days or so, my eyes have been very opened about some of the disinformation programs.
Well, what they're talking about is the Pentagon was trying to block the information. They didn't want to release the high-res radar tapes. And like the sci-fi movie, The Men in Black, they don't want the public to know what's really happening. So they come in, they take out the tape, and it's gone, and nobody can talk about it.
One thing I wanted to point out that I put in our chat earlier is that, so you wonder why with all this automation and this literally multi-million dollar Spy 1 radar, what do you need Kevin Day for? And the reason that you need Kevin Day, and when you hear him talk, and he'll talk about that, is the reason that he went to Top Gun school is not because the radar does everything automatically. The reason he went to Top Gun school and graduated is because he has seen thousands of tracks. So he can look at something and know what he's seeing and know the capabilities correctly of what he's seeing. And that's the value of a radar operator on a system.
Radar operators know what they're seeing, and they're seeing real objects. And these guys are just verifying that.
But by the time that they send Fravor and Dietrich out to this object, there's been a ton of observation, a ton of electromagnetic energy that has been directed in the field of operation. There's been a laundry list of things that the professionals have gone through to assess whatever this or these things might be. And they've confirmed that it is something there. There is something there. It's not just sort of a weird glitch in the technology. It's not an anomaly. There's something that needs to be investigated further. So Fravor and team are sent to Vector on this target. When they get there, This is what interests me. When they arrive at this location, Fravor talks about the observation, looking down below to the sea level and seeing the churn in the water and seeing the erratic motion of this object. As a pilot who, you know, flies a lot out in open water and the things that you're used to seeing, how did his account strike you, Chris, in terms of what would have been going through your mind if you had seen an object behaving in the way that he described?
Yeah, I mean, that was the video that changed my whole, you know, perspective, was that interview with Fravor and Lex Fridman. You know, I've tried, explain before that after a while, you know, you just get so used to it, you know, like you, DJ, you know, you've done so thousands and thousands of hours. You know, if somebody was explaining to you about a MC-130, you know, this type of mission that you did all the time and was explaining as you walk through, you know, here's the FLIR, I'm looking at this system and I see this, at least for me, after so many years, it felt like I was there. You know, it's as close as I can get to saying I saw something. You know, I haven't seen anything my brain didn't make sense of. At least, you know, physical movements. I've seen a lot of things my brain doesn't make sense of in the world. But as far as that, it really threw me off that what would I do? And that's funny, right? That's the whole point of training, is so when you get into a situation you haven't been to, you know, like whatever, getting shot at or something, that you will do what you practiced. And so in that case, I think for him was just try and get closer to it. You know, I'm sure he thought, can I get any video of this somehow? But he didn't have a pod. You know, he has no pod to try and video it. But I think the biggest thing is, what is that thing? You know, you talk about the inertial movements. You know, when it's just moving, when he describes it as it not moving like a helicopter. You know, if you look at a normal helicopter, it has to change its lift vector and then get back into, and it has to actually over rotate. Okay, mm-hmm. The same thing. You know, here, okay.
The rotor mast has to lean in that direction.
Yeah.
To counter the inertial.
It's just plain stuff. Yeah, woo! Like. Yeah, here's a MiG-29 broken, and then whatever, my one model that made it. Like say you're out of formation, right? You're this plane, and you're out of formation. You have to put in an acceleration, right? So you have to change the throttle. You have to push it forward faster than you need, essentially, right? To stay level. Like, let me see.
Yep, got it.
I want to be level with this guy, say, right? So I want to catch up. I have to push. I have to put more throttle in. I have to make one correction, right? And then in order to stop, if I don't change it, I'm going to keep accelerating, right? I'm going to keep accelerating. So you have to put in less power than you need to slow down and then fix it. You have to make three corrections. Does that make sense? I have to push the throttle forward to accelerate. Mm-hmm. So the plane, I'll start moving forward, right? But then I'm going too fast. I have to actually go back further than I need, so that I slow my momentum, and then I have to push it forward to make it the correct thrust that I need. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So you need three fixes to change your lift vector, essentially. At least from my experience. Okay, I'm sure there's physics guys that are gonna.
Yeah. Can I? I just want to ad lib one thing, just to give, and it's not trying to butter up you or the fighter pilot community. But I'm from the AFSOC community, MC-130, AC-130 community. I have asked people about this. I've talked to the CV-22 community, the MC and AC-130 community. And I'm sure if I were to be able to talk with the 160th, they would say something similar. You guys are the best in the world when it comes to identifying something in the air and evaluating its capabilities, full stop.
Yeah,
I can have thousands of flight hours in an MC or an AC-130, but it doesn't mean that I understand aerial engagement. So if somebody is a lay person that's never done this, you don't know how far away you are from their level of knowledge when it comes to looking at something in the air, identifying it, and evaluating what its capabilities are and how freakish they may be or may not be.
And what they're talking about is that these pilots, these fighter pilots, know what they're doing, know what they're seeing. And again, they saw a real object. It wasn't swamp gas or bald lightning or whatever.
Yep. Yeah. I'm going to ask a question about that too, though. So if they're coming into this to this area where the object is moving, if the object weren't bouncing around the way they described it, and if there wasn't the churn in the ocean that was described, let's say it was a stationary tic-tac approximately 40 feet long close to the surface of the water,
yep.
Is this something that
it's bizarre,
but is this something that would have caught the eye of a pilot? Like would he have flown right by it?
Yeah, when you look at how they actually locked onto the GoFast video, that's the point. So the argument that they're making, right, that it's a bird or it's a balloon or something, is that it's essentially stationary. Okay, I mean, unless a bird, anything going less than 50 knots to us is essentially kind of stationary. Our radars can't really see it. It's very difficult for our radars to see it. Helicopters are very difficult to actually see and engage just because they're so slow. You know, the way our systems work is your radar is going to pick up movement. So your radars pick up movement as well. Basically velocity change, so the Doppler shift on that pulse train, right? But your eyes work exactly the same way. And this is why when we're fighting, right, if I'm trying to intercept you, right, and say you're flying in your plane, you know, like this, right? I'm not gonna, as I do my intercept around, I'm not gonna be here and just fly around like this so you can just see me on the horizon. You know, I'm basically going to go low or high, and I'm going to point right at you. So as I'm making this intercept to your rear, see, as I'm intercept, when I'm going to your tail, you can't see me because because I'm point on.
Right.
Because you're not seeing this rapid movement. You're not seeing a plane form and line of sight. You see less. I don't want a fast movement on the horizon, you know. So environmentals make a huge difference. They make a huge difference. You know, the sun, where the sun's coming from, how the clouds decks are laid, the moisture in the air, how far you can see. Mm-hmm. And Kevin Day, they know all this stuff. You know, when they do their check-ins, what's the weather, and then you give this weather briefing. So to see, and that was a big thing for me on this, is it's just a clear day. They say it's just a clear day. There's nothing out there. It's like you're walking, you know, you're just walking to the coffee shop, and right across the way, you see like this, you know, this flying thing going like this and just moving around, you know, and there's nobody else around, you know. I mean, that's basically the same analogy I would say is.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about what does it take for an object to do that? So Nathan alluded to there's something under the surface that they have described as a fuselage-looking object under the water that's making the water boil, or at least disturbing the water. And so these guys have seen probably by this time hundreds of submarines that have come to the surface, and it wasn't that. So it's something else. And they see this object buzzing around, but it's moving in an erratic way.
Yes.
What does it take for something to do that? So we have an object, an aerial object. I'm not going to call it a flying object for reasons we can get into later. But what does it take to do that, Chris? Propulse something like that?
It has zero inertia. I mean, it has zero momentum. You know, so that's why in order to, you know, a helicopter has to put our lift back in. You know, we put our lift vector this mm-hmm. way, we'll turn. But then if you want to go the other direction or stop your direction, you have to actually accelerate back to level. You know, that's why, you know, we accelerate to something and then we have to decelerate when something moves. You know, it gets faster to here and then it slows down, stops, and then it gets faster, it slows down. So your acceleration vectors are constantly changing. And with this, there's no inertia. It's like it's light or something. It's, you know, it doesn't adhere to our laws of physics. You know,
right, the way that we interact with something in the air. So
it's like a laser pointer. Yeah, if you flick a laser pointer around, that's kind of how it reminds me of it.
Right,
actually moving around.
And so we get to that point. And now Dave Fravor has been vectored onto it, and he looks down and he sees it. And at some point, he tells his wingman, Alex Dietrich, you stay high, I'll go low. And he points his nose down, at which point now the object, according to Dave, points the oblong nose of the Tic Tac at him. So you as a fighter pilot are thinking what when that happens?
Yeah, this is probably the biggest difference for me on the Nimitz and the Fravor engagement. Because that's what you're always wondering. So, you know, if I'm fighting with someone, you can tell immediately if they can't see you, right? It's this old adage, lose sight, lose fight. You know, if you merge with someone to fight them, you know, and by merge normally is, you know, you haven't been able to identify or shoot each other prior to this point, and then you pass high speed, and now you're trying to get your weapons on first, right? So you know you've engaged with an enemy, and so now you're trying to get your weapons on as fast as possible. So it's basically from this engagement, I can tell exactly what normally is when they don't see you. They're kind of continuing. You're like, where is he pointing? You know, like where mm-hmm. where is he going? Does he know I'm coming to shoot him? You know, and mm-hmm. and usually it's because they don't know, because it's just so hard to keep track of these planes.
Well, we're getting a lot of information about how the planes go after their targets, and Dave Fravor was up there with Alex Dietrich, and they saw it with their eyes.
Like the same thing I was trying to say with the go fast, it's you can barely see a fighter at 4 nautical miles. You know, you can barely see a fighter at 4 nautical miles. And if I'm pointing at you like I just showed you, you're not going to see me at 4 nautical miles. Like it's just, you know, we talk about this. If I'm pointed like this, you're going to see me. You know, to see a bird flying at 4 nautical miles, like halfway between you and the ground, is just impossible. It's like, okay, we can talk all the semantics about focal length and depth of field or whatever, but you know, basically for them to get the lock in the go fast video, they had their sensor on the ground, you know, on the water, essentially, because they saw it with their eye. You know, they put their little sensor box, you know what I'm talking about, you know, they put mm-hmm. their little sensor box out in front of it, looking outside through your helmet, and then waiting for the little white ball to fly into there, and then you look down, there it is, and now they take the lock.
That was a sweet moment.
Well, you can do that if you see it, right? If you see it, because it's a mm-hmm. white ball traveling right over the white paint.
Black,
you
know, water.
The blue water. It's bright mm-hmm. blue water. And if you see this little white ball, you see that movement, you pick it up. You know, you will see a little white speck moving across the sky on a blue background easily.
You need contrast. You've got to have contrast.
Yeah, but if it's up at 13,000 feet, it's halfway between you and the horizon. It's already 4 nautical miles anyway to see a bird with your eyes. And it's not moving. I mean, it's just not possible. So, I mean,
and they actually saw it. Then they locked onto it.
But let me go back to my question.
Yep.
Your Fravor, you nose over and you see the object turn, and face you. What are you thinking at that time?
This is the first engagement where it's maneuvering in relation to them. And that is where you can talk about why it's extraordinary. For me, this is why it's extraordinary, you know, because they look at the Omaha, you look at those other events, and we hear that, hey, these balls, they were maneuvering in relation, they were following the ships, you know, it's tracking right along. But it's not exactly, it's not as obvious, at least for me as a pilot, when that thing points at you, it's like someone, if I can see the plane, like move, like if he points his lift vector, a lift vector is, you know, where if I pull, that's where I'm going to turn, mm-hmm. you know, I can, if he points it like this, you know, you can tell he's looking at me, you know, mm-hmm. it feels like the plane's looking at me, you know? And so that's what I would have felt, man, is like,
I've just been engaged. That's what I was thinking when Fravor said that. And then it started coming up co-altitude with him.
Yeah, so he's talking about a two-circle fight. I have my mm-hmm. some pens here. So basically, you have the little tic-tac over the water. So he's searching this little patch of water down here, okay? And they said it was like the size of a 737 under the water.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had your Fravor. I'll put him in green up here. He's with his two ship, right? So they arrived there at 25K. And so Dietrich, she just holds above, right? She's holding up here. And basically the holding pattern you're going to use is one where you can turn and see, you know, see the ground. So basically 3 to 4 miles just right overhead in a constant turn. So, she's going to stay within, I would say this is like 2 to 3 nautical miles. You can read that. So this is probably 2 to 3 nautical miles radius of a circle, and then you're looking at like 4 miles high, so that just gives you an idea of that. So basically she's going to stay up in this holding pattern with Slate, right? Commander Slate.
This is amazing information, how the two planes are tracking the Tic Tac.
Slate was the backseater for Fravor, I believe, but I'm not positive.
Yeah, so he's your experienced, he's your super experienced Wizzo. From my understanding, it sounds like he's running this engagement, at least from the back, he's the experienced, Dietrich, from what I understand, was new. She's brand new. I think this guy, this kind of situation, he's going to be running the show. And really, I think, Dietrich's probably just trying to gain SA and keep in the right formation. So as she descends, as Fravor descends down here, he's going to be, basically, in that same kind of over the ground turn, but down at this altitude, at a lower altitude, right? So he's descending down. If we look at above now, so let's say this is the center. So basically, they're orbiting this thing, right? You can see that. Mm-hmm. So Fravor, he's going to pitch his nose in and descend. Okay, so these are descend lines, and Dietrich's just going to stay up here watching him as he starts descending down, right? And he's going to fly just a lower circle around this thing. And so what happens is, as he starts descending down, it basically turns, and it starts descending up. This is above, remember? Now we're looking from above.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like, this is basically in a normal fight, when we're fighting, I kind of mentioned it a little bit, you're trying to turn faster than the other guy. You're trying to raid around the circle faster. But this thing is climbing, actually. So he's climbing back up. And that's what also was amazing to me is when this thing is climbing back up, it just climbs from a standstill. If you look at any air shows, like F-22s, they have to have some airspeed, 100 knots, maybe 50 knots. But then they still, it's a slow, climbing out.
Absolutely.
This maneuver right here, where it turns at them, it turns at Fravor, and then it maneuvers against him, is crazy. That's a mind-boggling kind of maneuver there, where it just comes up, and it's in relation to him. So it's, from everything I heard, it knows. It's flying in relation to him. So,
okay.
That's amazing.
So next Fravor moment is they're now in a circle where, as you said, Fravor might be slightly above the object because he leveled off when he saw it come up.
Yep.
And because obviously he's going to level off when he sees it gaining altitude, he's going to say, oh, okay, well, it's coming up. So yes. Now you have a guy who has no weapons aboard, no rounds of ammunition. And he decides to, I think they have a 40 millimeter on there, but they had no ammunition. And he decides to cut across the circle and aim his aircraft at this thing. So now we have one of two things that could happen. First of all, a Class A could happen because he could have actually hit it. And secondly, what strikes me as a non-fighter pilot aviator is the bravery it takes to do that.
Yeah, I don't think he thought about it. Let me draw this.
I mean, just, this is a guy who Dave Fravor's the type of guy that when they took his tapes and they brought it to another, I think they brought it to the CIC, and he went up there and said, "What'd you do with my tapes from that mission?" And he said, "Oh, we've got him." He goes, "You got 30 seconds to give me those tapes. I'm gonna start tearing this place apart." Like that's the type of dude that Fravor is.
Exactly. I mean, you don't get to the position, like I said, you don't get to that position by not being the man, essentially. I mean, it happens, but everything I see is he's the guy exactly like I would expect. You know, that's the guy we want leading in that position. And he's not going to not do it, you know. Okay, so basically here, I just continued. So what happens after a while is while they continue turning, remember, we're looking from above. So Fravor, he's the green line. They turn if we're looking. And so what you end up with is they're about a mile across, okay, from above. And this is a normal kind of fight. This is a neutral fight, we would call it, because we're both neutral. But what he's able to do is when you say cut across the circle, we do this to try and point your guns. This guy continues his normal turn. Then this guy, he's going to over-rotate, right? Over-rotate. And descend. So that's where you're going to do like a diving maneuver, and at some point in here it just like vectors off, right? So he's trying to affect a rejoin, he's trying to get closer to it, and it just, I still don't get it actually. He says it just disappears, but I don't know what's going on.
Well, you got to listen, he was on Fighter Pilot Podcast. He's been on a number of shows, but I've also heard him say it didn't like quote disappear, but it moved so quickly that it looked like it disappeared. Yeah, it just moved at such a rapid pace. But here we have a craft that if you listen to Kevin Day, that where it went from, he tracked it going from 28,000 feet to 50 feet in under 1 second.
Amazing, amazing information. Well, that was quite a discussion with Chris Lato and DJ San Marco. Amazing. Both pilots experienced in the equipment, and they were mainly analyzing Dave Fravor's interaction with the Tic Tac. To me, I'm convinced that it was a real object, and that both of them are convinced that it was a real object. And they were analyzing the angles of attack and how it approached and how the object pointed at Dave Fravor's F-18 and started up towards him like it was intelligently controlled, which it likely was. And amazing. This was about a 41-minute podcast out of almost 2-hour Q&A from Chris, DJ, and Nathan. I'd also like to thank Chris Lato for allowing me to use his podcast in my podcast and on my YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe to Chris Lato's channel. And also thanks to DJ and Nathan. The podcast is called Life, MMA, and NBA. There should be more to come, but if you like this blog, please subscribe. I'm at anchor.fm/Howard-Barenboim or Crazy Tech on YouTube. So please subscribe. And the subscribe button on YouTube is up on the right side of the screen. And thanks for stopping by.